Right then, so yes, my name is Paul, for anyone who doesn't know me. I'm one of the leaders of this site, and it's great to get to preach this morning. It's an honour and a privilege every time. As Ben just said, we're going to be restarting our series going through the Gospel of Matthew that we started earlier this year. We've called this series Big Issues, Bigger Kingdom, Money, Sex, Power and More, in the Gospel of Matthew, seeking to really look at the kind of big issues of the day and see what Jesus and his word has to say about them and into them. So we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 6 today, continuing in the Sermon on the Mount, and we'll get to the passage in just a moment. So for anyone who knows me reasonably well, you will know that I hate DIY. I really do. And recently, in the last month or so, we discovered a damp patch under the floorboards in our back room. And that kind of thing, for me, my heart just sinks. I don't know what to do. I don't even know who to talk to. You know, I've got no idea what to do. Is this going to cost me thousands of pounds? And I really resent spending proper money on my house that adds no tangible difference to my life. You know, I hate it. And I'm glad I'm not preaching in the city site right now with all the Warwick physics students. But I think the second law of thermodynamics is about things that just everything tends towards rot and decay and chaos and disorder, which actually is just a scientific paraphrase of Romans chapter 8, where it says all creation is subject to futility and waiting to be set free. We have to intervene. Everything wants to rot and decay around us, and we have to intervene and stop it. And that is basically my understanding of DIY, which I think means that when Jesus returns to make all things new, there'll be no more DIY anymore. And I'll be set free forever. So sorry for you weirdos who enjoy it. But, you know, we are onto a glorious trajectory. Something far better is coming. Right. All of that is to say we're in Matthew chapter 6. So if you want to turn to Matthew 6, verse 19, or it's up here if you don't have a Bible with you, you can read along on the screen. Ready? It says this. This is Jesus speaking. He says this. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Okay, we'll just pause there for a moment. So Jesus is talking about wealth here, possessions, material things, and the precarious nature of them. And we all know that, don't we? That actually wealth and, you know, material things are precarious. They are here today, gone tomorrow. You can get one phone call and your whole life will change. And so they're not really a great thing to put our eternal trust in. And actually, in Jesus' time, they were even more precarious because things were a lot less secure than they are today. They didn't have banks to keep your money in some weird digital form that doesn't really exist. Rather, they, you know, usually buried things under the floors of their houses because it was quite easy for thieves to break in, because usually the walls were made of mud bricks and you could just sort of tunnel through them quite easily if people weren't at home. It was harder to keep things like moths out and that kind of thing. So putting someone's faith, someone putting their faith in wealth and possessions in Jesus' time was even more precarious than it is today. We have this illusion that everything is nice and secure today, but it's not at all, really, is it? All things on earth are perishable, so what's the point of clinging to them? So Jesus says, instead of doing that, store up treasures in heaven. Don't store up treasures on earth. What does that actually mean? What is the treasure he's talking about? I don't think that it's meant to be that we sort of think of it as behaving really well now and then one day we'll get a bigger mansion in the sky. Sometimes we can think of it like that. But actually, really, that is just Western materialism with an eternal time frame, isn't it? So it's not really, I think, what Jesus is talking about. Instead, I think verse 21 is the key to this whole passage. Verse 21 says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So there is, I think, a universal human truth that you become like that which you love. that which you pour your affection and your time and your focus and your attention into, you actually become like that thing or that person. So Hannah and I have experienced this in our marriage. We've been married 18 years. Before we got married, we took one of those personality tests just for a laugh, and we found out that I was like 90-something percent introvert and Hannah was 100% extrovert. Opposites attract, I suppose. But actually, as over the years of our marriage, we have become a bit more like each other. I am now marginally more outgoing. I can hold a conversation for about 30 seconds, all right? And Hannah actually now sometimes likes to be on her own. She doesn't always need to be around people and talking all of the time, just 95% of the time. Okay, so we've actually become a little bit more similar to each other. We've become like each other as we've invested in each other and spent time with each other. And it's not just in marriage, actually any close relationship, it's true. Think of just close friends who spend lots of time together. You kind of, characters rub off on each other over time. You become more aligned. Your likes, your interests kind of merge together a little bit. You become more similar over time as you invest in one another. We become like what we love, where our heart is, what we give our time and our attention and our affection to. And we see this in a negative way in Psalm 115. I can't remember if I put the words up, but I'll read it to you anyway. Did I? No. I'll read it to you when I find it. So Psalm 115, verses 4 to 8 says this. Here we go. Their idols are silver and gold. So he's talking in a culture and context where people would make a god out of silver or gold or something and then worship that. Or rather, they were worshipping the image that it sort of, the representation. But anyway, their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak. Little statue, it's got a mouth, looks like it, but it can't speak. Eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell, hands but do not feel, feet but do not work, and they do not make a sound in their throat. And this is the important verse. Those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them. So what it's saying is if the object of someone's attention, time, affection and focus is actually kind of lifeless, cold, unfeeling, incapable of compassion, grace, love, then over time, the person will actually become a bit like them, will become a bit more cold, a bit less loving, a bit less compassionate, gracious or anything like that. Does anyone remember this guy? Yes. Does anyone remember this guy? Yes. There's probably a bit of a demographic window to remember this guy. There's probably people in this room who are either too young or too old to remember Scrooge McDuck. But I remember Scrooge McDuck. And Scrooge McDuck was a cartoon character, and the whole cartoon premise was this interaction between Scrooge and his three nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, who were like nuts. And always getting into trouble, a little bit like Alvin and the Chipmunks for the younger ones in the room. Okay, so they were always getting into trouble, full of energy, full of mischief and that kind of thing. And Scrooge McDuck, he was only interested in money, all right? He was money man, all of his focus and time was money. And so he kind of hated hanging out with his nephews because they took his attention away. Scrooge was mean, right? He was cold-hearted and uncaring and unkind. Scrooge McDuck is Psalm 115 lived out in cartoon form. Okay? His focus and attention was something that was cold and unloving because money is just an inanimate, made-up thing, really. It can't give back to you love and that kind of thing. And so actually, over time, his heart became like it. He became cold and uncaring and that kind of thing. Okay? So the thing is, the world knows when it comes to finance and money that we just intuitively know that someone who makes that their whole life's focus and attention turns out like Scrooge McDuck. That's why he exists. We know this, right? But in a positive sense, then, If our focus is on the most loving, most kind, most generous, most free, most gracious and merciful, wonderful person that there is, we become a bit like him as well. That person's Jesus. Okay, so that's what this is saying. That's where our treasure is. There our heart will be also. We will grow to be like that which we love. Okay, next couple of verses. Verse 22 and 23. The eye, this is Jesus speaking again, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? What does that mean? That's a complex little parable that Jesus just throws in there for fun to confuse people. Okay, but we have to understand this parable in its context, right? And this context is all about wealth, money, possessions, as is the verse that comes directly afterwards we'll have a look at in a moment. So this slightly complex little parable must be about wealth and possessions as well. And I think Jesus here is playing on a cultural metaphor that was around in the sort of Near Eastern times, actually still around today in these kind of cultures, the cultural metaphor of the evil eye. Does anyone recognize this thing? All right? This is a picture of an amulet that is supposed to protect people from the evil eye. What the evil eye is in this cultural metaphor is someone is the belief that if someone looks upon you with jealousy or with greed or covetousness towards you, then bad luck or even curses will come upon you. And these things are supposed to protect you from that. I had friends in London who had these hanging up in their car. And so this is still around today, this kind of metaphor, all right? And so this Jesus is talking about that, I think, here. That to have an unhealthy eye, as it were, is to have an eye that looks upon people with jealousy, with greed. That makes sense in the context that it's in, right? With Jesus talking about money and that kind of thing. And so then to the opposite of that, to have a healthy eye in this little parable, is rather to look upon people with generosity and grace and love, which again makes more sense in the context of the Sermon on the Mount as a whole, which earlier in this year we described as the way of love. Jesus just describing a life of love. So that's what Jesus is talking about. And if you think about it, we have similar phrases in English today, right? If you see someone who is really determined, we would say something like, they have fire in their eye. Yeah? Or if you saw someone who is really angry, you might say their eyes darkened. If you saw someone who was really depressed, you might say it looked like they had no life in their eyes. What we're saying is another phrase, that our eyes are like the window to our soul, right? They're like, it's like you can see in someone's eyes what's going on inside their hearts. That's the kind of metaphor that Jesus is saying here, okay? But more than that, actually, I think it doesn't just demonstrate what's going on inside, but actually enhances what's going on inside as we interact with the world in these ways. So Jesus is saying, if you feed into jealousy and greed and that kind of thing, then you will become more jealous and greedy rather than less. Whereas if you make the choice to feed into generosity and grace and kindness, you will become more generous and gracious and those kinds of things. Does that make sense? Okay, last verse says this. No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. And then Jesus says it just really plainly for the dimwits in the room like me, you cannot serve God and money. Good little summary at the end. Okay, Jesus here is saying you can't be committed to two masters. And if you think about it, bearing in mind everything we've just said, if it's true, all right, then it makes a lot of sense because you can't serve both because they lead in polar opposite directions. If you serve one, money, you might turn out a little bit like Scrooge McDuck. All right? If you pursue your hope to be finances and money and wealth and possessions, then actually the base knowledge that these things are perishable and insecure means that ultimately we will grow to be insecure, fearful, or just full of competition, resentment towards others, and that kind of thing. None of which are a fertile ground for love to grow. So that's serving one. If you serve the other, if you follow Jesus and pursue him and who he's like, then actually we grow to be like him, full of love and kindness and peace and security, which I think leads to freedom and generosity in radical ways. That's why we can't serve two, can't serve them both at the same time, because they lead in completely opposite directions. Okay, that's what the passage says. That's what you would expect me to preach from this passage this morning. Okay? The thing is, you probably know all of that already. All right? If you've been around church a little while, even if you haven't, you would just intuitively know, if I put all my faith and hope in money, then it's not going to make me a very nice person and it will leave me quite insecure. All right? And if you've been a Christian for a while, you know this. You know I need to put my faith in Jesus, not in my bank account and not in the fact that I have a job or don't have a job, or maybe I one day have a job or whatever it may be. You know this, right? So here's the question. Do you ever find yourself worrying about money? That's next week's sermon. Okay? Do you ever find yourself actually, maybe if you search your heart, a little bit more materialistic than you would perhaps like to be if you put, you know, if you were able to live in the fullness of what you know to be true? Anyone? Right. So I've told you what you know already, because you already know that. What I want to talk about for the rest of our time then is something that I want us to consider as we start a new academic year, a focus for us, and that is discipleship. Discipleship, following Jesus, is far more a matter of our heart than it is a matter of our brains. It's far more about the desires of our heart than what we know in our minds, okay? Because you already know, and yet we struggle still. And the reality is, it's not really how we approach it often in the modern West. We want to gain knowledge and information and understanding, and if we have enough, then maybe we'll live right. Okay, but actually the reality is, simply increasing in knowledge and information doesn't necessarily lead to life change. Okay, I know that eating too much chocolate and ice cream is bad for me. I know that. That knowledge made absolutely no difference over the summer to the copious amounts of chocolate and ice cream that I consumed on a very regular basis. That knowledge may as well have not been there. In fact, to be honest, it wasn't there in my mind. When I saw some ice cream, I thought, I want that. I will have that. Okay? And that's what I did. Knowledge alone doesn't necessarily change our behavior. We can know all sorts of things, but ultimately it is our desires that shape our behavior and therefore who we become far more than just the things we know. Advertising, people in advertising have known this for decades. Okay, when clever people are employed to sell a product, to advertise a product, they don't just try and logically convince you that their product is better than other similar products on the market. Rather, they go after your desires. If they've done a good job, then by the end of their advert, they want to have left you feeling, I want that thing. Because I want that is a far bigger motivating factor than, yes, that makes sense. Or even, I think that looks better. Okay? So think about this in terms of cars. I quite like cars, so sorry, that's where my mind works. But you can parallel it to any kind of product you like, all right? If you don't see Land Rover or Mercedes or Peugeot or anyone trying to win you with reason as to why their car is better. Otherwise, adverts would look like this. Our car is faster than the others. Here's our 0-60 speed. Our car is more reliable than others. You won't need to go to the garage as much. Or for the middle-aged in the room, our car has a bigger boot than others. You will be able to take both a family-sized tent and clothes for your children for a week's holiday camping at the same time. So you should buy our car. Little window into my summer there. In reality, when I come to buying a car, those facts are far more important. They're really more important, but advertisers know that that's not the way to persuade me. That's not the way to shape my behavior, that knowledge. Far more than that, they go after my desires. So instead of saying, our car's more reliable, or our car's faster, or our car has a bigger boot. By the end of the advert, they want me to go, oh, I don't really care how big the boot is. I want that car. I need to have that car. It will improve my life. It will make me who I want to be. And again, you can replace that with any product or thing you like. Holiday, new phone, pair of trainers, whatever it may be, I want that. I don't need it. I want it. Our desires are what shape our actions far more than our knowledge. Now, don't get me wrong. Knowledge is important. It says in the Bible we need to be renewed in our minds. Okay, but actually, I think we also know that just head knowledge isn't enough. It needs to go into our hearts and shape our desires. So this year, as we begin a new academic year, I want to encourage us to focus on the desires of our hearts. Okay? And I think that there's a book that's interesting on this. Go to the next slide, Joe, please. This book, it's called Atomic Habits, Tiny Changes, Remarkable Results by James Clear. Right? This book, secular book, not a Christian book, has been in the Amazon top 20 most read charts for 307 consecutive weeks, which is nearly 6 years. There's only two other books with marginally higher consecutive weeks than that. And if you're nerdy, come and talk to me later, because there's something fascinating about the three together. I got very excited about it and then realized I didn't have time to tell you. Anyway, this book has been in the charts for 307 consecutive weeks. Now, why is that? Well, that is because James Clear, and probably now millions of others who've read his book, have realized that he's hit onto something. And that is, forming good habits, daily, small things included in our lives, shape our actions, but more importantly than that, over time, shape our desires than just knowing stuff. All right? Daily habits, good habits, shape who we become. Why? Because you invest in something, you say, I want to grow in this. Right, how do I do that? Well, this book says, here's a simple 6 methods to forming a good habit. Now, to start with, a habit has to be formed, and that's the kind of battleground. And if you give up, then it doesn't get formed, all right? But if you work at it to start with, then actually quite soon you see the benefit of it. And when you see the benefit of it, you actually begin to want to do it a little bit more. And want is the key word. That's a desires word, isn't it? And so actually our desires begin to be shaped by small key habits. Remember, it's far easier to grow in knowledge than it is to change desires. However, over time, it is our desires that shape us far more than the knowledge that we acquire. So this is what I want to encourage us in at the start of this academic year, okay? If you think that listening to exceptional preaching, Rosie's on in a few weeks' time, if you think that listening to good sermons is enough, it's not. It isn't. If you think, like I often do, that reading books on stuff is enough, it isn't. If you think just gaining knowledge and stuff is enough to shape the life in the direction that you want to go in, it isn't. If you are ever despondent about the slowness of change in your life, if you're ever frustrated that you know the right thing and yet your heart keeps wandering away from it, if you're ever confronted with the desires of your heart and they still conflict at a deep level with what you know to be true, then let me recommend starting some good habits in your life. These are not rocket science. They have been around for millennia for the people of God. Okay? They are very simple things, and in lots of Christian circles for a long time they've been called spiritual disciplines. But actually, you can forget that because it sounds religious. Go with good habits. It means the same thing. Good habits in your life of prayer, of worship, of reading the Bible, and of fellowship with other believers on a regular basis, these are the good habits that in time will shape the person you become far more than reading books or listening to amazing preaching. Rosie will be on soon. Okay? Why? Because these things connect us at a heart level to our maker and the lover of our souls. Just knowing about God is not the same as knowing him. It's, you know, listening to good sermons, going to church even, is not the same as walking with God in our daily lives. Being with God takes time, regularly, okay? If all you do is come to church and listen to some people speaking at the front and then go away and don't really think about it much until next Sunday, it won't have any impact on your life, all right? And I say that as someone who works really hard at preaching. I know I'm making a joke out of it, but I do, and we do. We work really hard at this because I believe in it, but I also know it's not enough. It's not enough. Being with God daily, regularly, is what we need. Sitting with him, being honest with him. Like in the Psalms where it says, "Search my heart, O Lord." That takes time. I don't think you can do that effectively on the bus. I don't. Praying on the bus, that's good, all right? But actually sitting and being with him is something else. Being honest with him, being honest with ourselves, maybe even, if you're being brave, being really honest with a couple of really trusted people, believers in your life as well. I'll be honest with you for a moment. I am far more comfortable letting people into what I know than letting people into the depths of my desires sometimes, right? It takes courage and honesty. I was talking to David Pollard recently. I asked him if it was all right to share this, and he said yes. And he has just, over the last 6 months or so, he's just begun to form some good habits in his life. Simple, right? Really simple. Maybe for 20 minutes a day, most days, he will find a time at the beginning of the day or the end of the day or somewhere in the middle of the day, and he will just sit and be quiet with God. With no agenda, with no, "God, I need you to do this, I'm worried about that, please help this person," to just sit and be quiet and be like, "I'm here and I'm yours and I'm glad." And then he'll open the Bible and read a chapter or two. And he's done that most days now for 6 months or so, and he said, "It's amazing, it's really good." And to begin with, it was something he had to fight for a little bit because it wasn't something he was doing like he's doing it now. Okay, so it was a bit of like, a bit of work at the beginning, but now he's seen the benefit of it, more peaceful, more all the good stuff, right? And so now actually it's something that he wants to do. It's no longer a, "Oh yeah, I've got to fit that in." It's like, "Oh yeah, I'm definitely going to make time for that, for him, for Jesus." That's where our desires get shaped. Okay, Jesus doesn't say here, "Where your treasure is, there your mind will be also." He says, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be." The thing that shapes you the most, the thing that shapes who you become the most. And from the context of these verses, Jesus is talking about wealth and money and finances and possessions. And he's saying, these things, wealth and money and products and blah, 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 they affect our desires. They can appeal to our desires, and so we have to be careful with them. They can form us in ways that perhaps we wouldn't like to be formed if we sat down and thought about it, but without thinking about it, we just, our heart goes there. And that's the thing. There's a guy called John Mark Comer, who's a great preacher in America, who's written some really helpful books as well. He talks about like how you are being formed always by something. You're not neutral in this world. You can't just float along and not be formed. I am always being formed on a daily basis. The question is, are you being formed by what you want to be formed by, or who you want to be formed by? And the solution, the way, is good habits. Okay, but it's not just about money, is it? Anything can form us. It's whatever you give your time, your attention, your affection to, that is forming you. Where your treasure is, your heart will be also. So where is your treasure? Where is your heart? Where are your desires? It can be helpful sometimes to just pause and take a bit of an inventory. What am I spending my time, my free time, my spare time at the end of the day or before I go to work? Where is my head? Where is my heart? What am I being formed and shaped by? I did this a couple of weeks ago, just drawing till the end of my summer holidays or the summer holidays. I wasn't on holiday for the whole time, but the summer holidays. And I thought, do you know what? The habit that I've fallen into because I wasn't really thinking about it is get to the end of what is often quite a long day, get to the end at 9 o'clock or 9:30, And my habit, without thinking about it, is pick up the remote control, press Netflix, sit down, boom. There's nothing wrong with that, don't get me wrong, all right? It's fine. But my habit was that, and my habit was far less just sit and be with God for a bit. And so I thought, actually, well, I don't want to be unthinkingly shaped by what I watch on Netflix. I want to be shaped by Jesus. I really do. That is my deepest desire. And so I decided to form a better habit. So for September, this just a month, I've given up screens, in brackets, apart from watching Arsenal games. I'm allowing myself that, and I think Jesus is okay with it, all right? So I'm not watching screens. Of an evening, I get to the end of the day, it's 9 o'clock, I've got an hour or so before I should probably try to go to sleep. So now I don't have screens as an option, so I'm just going and sitting and being with God for a bit and reading some Bible. And you know what? I've only been doing it, what, a week? It's already good. It's not that I wasn't praying or wasn't reading the Bible, but it wasn't like, no, I actually need this central and need to prioritize this. I want to be formed by him, right? So what I want to do with the rest of our time, we've got 15 minutes, is to give you that opportunity right now. Because I'm sure you've got a busy day ahead of you and other things will fill your mind and you'll have other plans to make and things to think about. But now you've got 15 minutes with nothing else to do. You're welcome. So you can use this time to think. I quite like thinking in the presence of God. You know that thing where you're kind of praying, but you're kind of not quite praying because you haven't really thought about it that much? I do this quite a lot. Here I am, Lord, and then my mind just goes and I'm thinking in the presence of God. And I find often God speaks to me in that process. So what I want to do, Steve's going to come back and lead, just play some music. Just take some time. Just take some time to consider right now, where's your heart? Where's your treasure? And what really we mean by that is, where are you investing time? What are you being formed by? What are your habits on a day-to-day basis? Have you fallen into the Western trap of thinking, if I know enough, then I'll be formed that way? Or is there a different way to think? Okay, so we're going to have 10 minutes or so. We'll come back together in 10 minutes or so, and we'll sing, we'll bring it together and worship again. But just take some time. Just consider, what are your habits? Are you being formed in the way that you want to be formed? And if not, or if maybe less than you'd like, what could you do about it? What very simple habits could you start this week, today, tomorrow, to be formed by Jesus if that is what you want? If you're here and you're not a Christian, then take this time and just think about, well, where has your life brought you so far? How are you being formed? What is your life producing? Is your life characterized more by peace or by anxiety? Is your life characterized more by joy or by stress, more by generosity and freedom, or more by the fear that I never quite have enough and all of the insecurity that can fall out from that place? And then ask, is that what you want? Is that what you want for your life? Is that how you want to continue? And if not, then let me recommend to you Jesus. All right? Just consider him. Consider if there's a better way. Consider the hope that he offers, which is not just about this life, but stretching into all eternity. Consider the security and the peace that comes from knowing that I don't have to have it all together. I'm trusting in him. Consider the fact, and we don't like to think about this very often, but it's one of the only universally true things in humanity. One day, you're going to die. Consider what happens on that day. What happens next? What do you really believe at a deep level? I am now someone, I wasn't always, but I am now someone who is at utter peace with that day because my hope is in Jesus. I believe we're all going to stand before God one day and give an account for our lives, and I am going to stand there and say, I have got nothing, he is my hope. And I'm going to point to Jesus, and I know he's enough. He's the gift I've received, so that I don't have to be enough, because I'm not and could never be. He is enough. Consider that. Is that true? 21 years ago, in a couple of weeks' time, I prayed a very simple prayer at an evening church service like this. Well, I wasn't really a Christian. I was in a right mess, and I prayed this prayer. Jesus, if you're there, I need some help. That was it. And I tell you, from that day, I found him to be true. I continue to find him to be true, and I'm absolutely confident I will always find him to be true. So consider him. If you're not a Christian, consider your life. Consider whether he has a better life to offer. That's it. Thank you very much. Wasn't expecting that. You can come again, you two. The rest of you, come on, buck your ideas. No, I'm joking. So just take some time. You got sort of 5, 6, 7 minutes. Just consider, where's your life? Where's it at? Is it being formed the way you want it to be? Consider Jesus. And then Steve will help us in some worship.